Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What was life like for your ancestors during the wars that shaped our history? Ancestry.com.au might be able to help you find these answers. I use Ancestry all the time to make Forgotten Australia episodes about life during wartime. Whether it's RAAF pilot Jim Brough, one of Australia's first masters of the air, or nursing sister Ellen Savage, who was so brave after the sinking of the Centaur, I rely on Ancestry's collection of records to help me bring the past to life. I'm always delighted by the amount of detail to be found. Names, ranks and serial numbers are just the beginning. There are also birth and marriage dates, addresses and occupations, physical descriptions, photos and signatures, and so much more. All discoverable in original documents that are digitally available at my fingertips. These are the very same resources that you can use to tell your family stories. Ancestry has the world's largest online collection of genealogical information. There are more than 40 billion records, and new records are being added all the time, so fresh discoveries are always possible. To help get you started, Ancestry is offering free access to all military records from Australia, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom until the 26th of April 2024. There could be more to your story. Piece it together with Ancestry. Registration required and terms apply.
You competed in the wrestling events for the first 4 days. The fifth day, you're sitting in the Olympic Village, and then what do you hear?
Oh, bang, bang, bang. And I thought, so I was in Vietnam the year before, so I knew what an AK-47 sounded like. And I thought, oh, not here, because this is the Olympics.
The special Forgotten Australia series, Sydney's Red Year, will conclude after the weekend. In the meantime, though, to commemorate Anzac Day, I'm presenting to you a conversation I had on Friday the 24th of April with John Kinsella. John Kinsella is an Aboriginal man, a dual Olympian, a Vietnam veteran, and a survivor of PTSD and, most recently, cancer. He's a fascinating individual. Just a note, due to social distancing, we couldn't do this interview face-to-face, so we had to do it over the phone. There are a few technical issues, but I think John's story really shines through. I hope you enjoy the conversation and find it as illuminating as I did. Lest we forget. John Kinsella, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to me today. Let's start at the beginning. Who were your mum and dad?
My mum, her father was second generation English, and the mother was from the Jawoyn tribe up in the Northern Territory, lost generation, and she was brought up by white people in South Australia.
Tell me about your dad.
He was born in Condobolin, which is Wiradjuri country, and mum's Jawoyn, so we've got a mixture of Jawoyn and Wiradjuri, yeah.
And whereabouts did you grow up?
Well, I was born in Surry Hills in 1949. The earliest memories of me was in Newtown. Now, we lived there in the 50s, and then we moved to Nowra. It was a little bit of an adventure for us because at the time there was 9 of us. When we moved down there, we lived in a little wooden house. We didn't have any electricity or water taps.
It was pretty
Mum used to do all the washing down the creek, and we used to have a wood burner stove.
So it was pretty tough.
It was. Back in them days, they were just wooden rafters and with tin roofs.
Now, you were the oldest of 9 kids, is that right?
Yes, I was. So when we lived down there, there was 9 of us. So I was the eldest of the 9. One of the reasons we moved out there, we had my dad's auntie lived down there. It was just one happy big family, you know. I mean, we all shared everything. To get food, we used to go fishing, and sometimes we used to go kangaroo hunting. We hunted pigs, and we kind of lived a little bit of the rough life, you know, because back in them days, there wasn't a lot of money to be made. So we used to just live the best we could, you know. And Dad sometimes wasn't in work, and that's the way it was back in the 50s.
So it was a pretty happy existence, if kind of tough by today's standards. But then things took a bit of a dark turn. Your sister had a bad accident.
Yeah, well, we had an open fire, and one of the youngest sisters, she had a nylon 90 on and caught fire, and she ended up with third-degree burns, and she had to be rushed to Nowra. Now, back in them days, there weren't any freeways. It took about 4 hours to go from Nowra to Sydney in the ambulance. She was put into the Children's Hospital at Camperdown, and she was there for quite a few years, and she was getting skin grafts. So we eventually had to move up to Sydney. And the only place we had to stay was my mother's sister's house. And there was seven of them, and there was 11 of us. God. So that's 18 people in a house. It was like a three-bedroom housing commission. You know, that's how we survived back in them days. My auntie lived at Greenacre, and we even went to school and everything there.
So you had bad luck with your sister's accident, and then more bad luck when your dad lost his job. Tell us about that.
Back in them days, like, he wasn't a tradesman or anything. He mainly worked in a sock factory. He used to do press the socks and things. And when he lost his job, Mum ended up having to go to the Salvation Army's community centres out at La Perouse. And she actually took the younger girls. And there was me and my brother. We went to a boys' home. And the older sisters, they actually ended up in a girls' home. And they were in Mittagong and we were in Bowral.
What was it like in the boys' home in Bowral?
Well, it was a little bit brutal because the governor, you know, if you stepped out of line, he'd give you a bit of a bashing. You know, many young boys used to get a kick or a smack. It wasn't a very good life. And I actually was pretty good at school, but when Dad got a job and we eventually got a place in Redfern, I went to Cleveland Street High School, and I was only in sixth class then, just before high school, and the work was totally different, and I kind of dropped the grades, so that by the time I did the test to go into high school, I ended up going to a secondary high school in Burke Street down in Redfern. That's where I lacked in my future education. And with 9 children in the family, I had to leave school when I was 14 to help Mum and Dad support the kids.
So what sort of work did you do?
Well, my first job ever was with a place called Fleming's, which is something like Woolworths. I actually got a job as a store person, and I got a certificate from the boss at Fleming's for being a good worker. And when we moved to Redfern, that's when Dad got me into the Boy Scouts.
You excelled at the Boy Scouts, didn't you, and the Duke of Edinburgh Award?
In 1968, I received the Queen Scout Award, and then I got the Duke of Edinburgh Gold Award at the same time. And the Duke of Edinburgh Award I actually received off the Duke himself at Narrabeen Fitness Camp.
That's great. Now, tell me about living in Redfern in those early days, in the sort of late 50s, early 60s. What was it like there? What was the community like?
In around Redfern, you know, my involvement was with the Boy Scouts, and because I left school at 14, I wanted to do physical sport, and that's how I used to go to the South Sydney Police Boys Club, and I found out one of my uncles knew one of the boxing coaches at Leichhardt, and he actually introduced me to him. And after 2 weeks, the boxing coach didn't show up, and so I went upstairs looking around, and then I saw the wrestling, and I said to the wrestling coach, I said, "Oh, how do I get into wrestling?" He said, "Oh, we've got a competition on next Tuesday. Just bring a pair of shorts and come along and we'll put you into a competition." I went into the competition and actually got the state champion.
You were up against the state champion straight off.
Yeah, I had about 4 wrestles and I ended up, I come second, but that state champion. That was the only time he ever beat me.
In the early 60s, sorry, in the mid-60s, when you were first introduced to wrestling, what sort of exposure had you had to wrestling up to that point?
They used to have professional wrestling on the TV, and I actually went to the old stadium down in Rushcutters Bay. I went down there a few times to watch the professional wrestling.
Who were your wrestling heroes?
Well, there was Mark Lewin and Killer Kowalski and all those.
So how good were you at wrestling straight off, and what did you really love about it?
It was a combat sport, and you were, when you get on the mat, there was only you and your opponent. So it was usually the most technical and the strongest wrestler that won. I actually excelled in fitness. I used to train really hard. And I was fortunate that I was actually training with past Olympians. So that's what brought my ability up. So when we had the trials, I won all my matches by fall. I had five wrestles and I pinned everybody within the first or second round. So... And that's one of the reasons I got selected.
So this is 1968, February, March, and you're just winning every single time, pinning every opponent. When you were selected for Mexico City Olympics, that was Anzac Day 1968 that it was announced in the newspapers. How did you feel?
It was just amazing, you know, to actually get picked.
Was this your first time outside of Australia?
Oh, it was, yes.
First time on a plane?
On a plane, yeah.
How was it? How exciting was it?
It was just fantastic. And because of the high altitude, we had to do acclimatisation. So we actually were one of the first teams into the Mexico Olympics, and we spent quite a few weeks there. In the village, they had like apartments, and the wrestlers, we had our own apartment. And because I used to grind my teeth, they ended up putting my bed out in the hallway. I was the youngest wrestler to actually represent Australia at that time.
You were also one of Australia's first Aboriginal athletes at the Olympics. How did that feel? Were you conscious of representing Aboriginal Australia?
But with the Olympics, it's one of those events where everybody's equal, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what colour you are. After the Olympics, you know, because people know that you're Aboriginal, they always bring up the word you discriminated against. A lot of people, at the time, I used to have a moustache and people thought I was a Mexican.
So tell me, what was Mexico City like when you got there? Was it a culture shock for you?
It was, because at that time there was a lot of political things going on. And actually drove past one of the buildings where there were bullet holes in one of the universities there. And that kind of scared you a little bit. But virtually 2 years later, I was in Vietnam looking at the same bullet holes.
Did you feel like a bit of a superstar? Or I read somewhere that you were being asked for autographs.
There was actually a village just across the from the Olympic Village, and it was like an Aboriginal settlement down in the country, you know. The people used to come down to the main gate. You had to learn a little bit of Spanish, and the first thing I had to learn was Lucha Libre, which is freestyle wrestling, because they used to ask what sport I did, and they were the two words, Lucha Libre, freestyle wrestling.
I can understand why you would have been a superstar there. The Mexican people do love their wrestling. Now, you went up against some pretty tough competition in that Olympics. How proud were you of how you competed against the Italian wrestler who was the European champion?
Yeah, it was a bit daunting because I didn't find out that Italian, how good a wrestler he was until I got back to Australia. And then I found out he was European champion. So he was the best wrestler in all of Europe. So I actually got the best of the European. First up.
You were there at the Olympics when Peter Norman took the dais beside Tommy Smith and John Carlos and gave the Black Power salute. How much of that did you understand at the time in terms of what it meant and the controversy surrounding it?
Well, we only seen most of that content on TV, and it wasn't kind of blowing up until you you got back home, because you've got to remember it. I was only 19, and a lot of the politics, you know, it wasn't until years later that the all of that kind of. Because I actually met Peter Norman a couple of times. That he was a gentleman, and what they did to him for the Munich Olympics was a shame.
So coming home after the Olympics, 1969, was a tough year for you?
I actually got beaten for the Australian Wrestling Championships, and I got called up for national service. So
it's quite a year. It's quite a year.
69 wasn't a good year for me. So
your Uncle Reg was the first Aboriginal man to be a commissioned army officer. How much of a hero to you was he growing up?
I knew him when I was younger, but because when he came back from Korea, he ended up going a different path. He ended up, he was married to my auntie, and they divorced, and I didn't have very much to do with him at all. You've got to remember, back in them days, I was an athlete, and when I got called up for national service, that was a different thing altogether.
So you didn't object terribly to being drafted at that point?
Well, it was just one of those things, you know.
So what was training like at Kapuka?
I loved it. And then during that period of time, you selected where you wanted to go or what sort of job you wanted to do. And everybody said, oh, you went to the Olympics, you should be a PDI, which is physical training. And then I found out that I was at the School of Artillery. And that's one of the reasons I ended up in the School of Artillery. I put my hand up to be a PDI. And then after recruit training, I ended up in 123 training back here, which is at Holsworthy. And that's the School of Artillery. But most of the Nashos went through Holsworthy. And at that time, I put down physical training instructor, and there was no courses run at that time, and then they asked for volunteers to go to Vietnam, and 90% of the class put their hand up, so I put my hand up, and within 3 weeks, I was up in Canungra training to go to Vietnam. When I got to Canungra, a lot of the soldiers found out that there was an athlete, there was a soldier that went to the Olympics. And then when they found out it was me, they used to ask me what I did, and I said I was a wrestler. And at that time, a lot of the soldiers only knew about the professional wrestlers, and that's where I got the nickname Killer.
Like Killer Kowalski.
Killer Kowalski, and then we'd be out marching, and then all of a sudden somebody say, "Hey, Killer," and the word spread. And even when I was in Vietnam, they used to call me Killer. And
did you like the nickname Killer?
Oh well, it was, you know, it was mine was very unique, if you know what I mean.
So tell me about leaving Australia and going to Vietnam.
We spent a night at South Bend, the naval depot there, and then they took us by bus out to Mascot. When we got to Tonsonute Airport, then they had to fly us to Nui Dat, and I had a vehicle pick me up, and I spent a night in Nui Dat, and we had there was a battery sergeant major, and he's one of them sticklers for typical artillery. You had to have spit polished boots, and virtually had to have iron greens and everything. And when I went out to the horseshoe the next day, I had a truck take me out there. And on the way out to the horseshoe, we went past this compound. It was in Arvin, which is the South Vietnamese Army base. And there was all these plastic bags, black plastic bags, and they were bodies that had contact of some sort. And then in 1968, they had what they call the Tet Offensive. And when you went through Dat Doe, which is one of the little villages, not far from Newey Bat, there was bullet holes in all the some of the buildings. Some of the buildings were blowing up, and kind of reminded me a little bit of when I was in Mexico City.
Wow! Now tell us what was the horseshoe in terms of geography and in terms of its importance militarily.
Well, the horseshoe was like a volcanic crater, and because it was the shape of a horseshoe, they had the guns down the front of the actual. Imagine a horseshoe. Well, the open part of the shoe. The guns pointed to the mountains, the long highs. The VC, they had all their tunnel systems there. And the 8 months that I was there, they used to bomb the long highs with B-52 bombs. We used to use artillery, and we used to send artillery bombs over there, and so it was a pretty strategic place. So with the artillery piece, you had a range of up to 7 to 9 Ks. And so when the infantry patrols went out, they have in the patrols, they have forward observers, which were artillery guys, and they were surveyors. And they're the guys that used to call in the artillery. So if you heard a long pan where they actually call artillery in on themselves, that was all done by forward observers that are all qualified surveyors. And so when they used to go out in the bush, they used to do the infantry used to get the surveyors to do all the map reading because they knew how to read a map. There's a lot of illumination rounds.
Yeah.
Now, whenever there was a contact during the night time, the infantry used to call in for illumination. Now, what illumination used to do was, after there was a big contact, they used to go through the area to see who was killed and that sort of thing. So there was one night there, we fired over 250 rounds, and they were all, a lot of that was illumination.
This is lighting up the night sky so infantry can see what's happening on the ground around them.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Just winding back just a second, when you saw those piles of body bags, how did it make you feel? Can you remember at the time?
You've got to kind of been a little bit hardened. Because I didn't tell you, but when I was in Mexico, I went to a bullfight, and there was actually a couple of... the matadors actually got killed by the bulls, and so I kind of hardened myself up to somebody being killed. And when you see a body bag, but you don't actually see the bodies; it was just the bags. You know, I guess it's an afterthought that, well, you know, that it could be me. You know, I actually did lose a mate over there. We went for Canunga, and he was an APC driver, and there was a helicopter come in to for their roof supply, and his APC was too close, and he popped his head out of the turret. He was one of the drivers, and his APC was too close to the chopper, and the blade clipped him on the head, and... yeah, he died. Yeah, well, actually, it was the brother of one of the guys on my unit who was on my gun, had to escort the body back home to Australia.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Well,
In the field, in the combat zone, were you frightened, anxious? Did you sleep well? Did you fear being overrun?
Oh, there was one time we went out to this support base, and we only had one gun, but we were teamed up with an American artillery, and they had a gun on. It was like an army tank, but their barrel was way bigger than ours, and if they had a fire mission, they'd be firing over our sleeping quarters, and we'd be sleeping, and all of a sudden the repercussions from all the vibration from their armoured vehicle would our beds would shake and kind of jump about 2 or 3 inches off the floor.
Mm.
You know, and this is what it was like in the Horseshoe. Every time there was a fire mission, if people fired over you, all the vibration goes forward. And, it's not good to... the trouble with artillery's in action 24/7.
So you were in Vietnam for 8 months and then came back to Australia.
I had the opportunity to do the full 12 months. So the unit was over there 4 months before I got there. And when the unit was coming home, I decided to come over the unit because the Olympics were on in 72 and I hadn't done any training at all. The only training I did was they used to let me run around the Horseshoe sometimes, you know. And we used to do exercises at the gun position. So when I got back to Sydney, I ended up... the unit was stationed up in Townsville. So I had a couple of... about a week or so leave. And then I spent 2 days in the train getting up to Townsville. And when I get up to Townsville, they said, John, pack your bags, you're off down to Manly. I said... Why, what happened? They said, we'd put you on the physical training instructor schools. I packed my bags and I was off down to Manly.
And how did you go in the physical training instructor course?
It was a bit of an eye-opener for me because the physical training instructor, I thought it was just fitness. It was actually the equivalent to a phys ed teacher at high school. And I haven't left school at 14, I didn't actually get enough points to pass the final test. I got about 65 and you had to get 70. And when I got back to Townsville, I got a bit of a roasting from the the CO, and he because he said, you went to the Olympics and all this. And not long after I got back up there, I got tonsillitis and I ended up in Townsville Hospital, and at that time, tonsillitis was not a good operation to have because a lot of people died. And I guess it's the toughness of me doing the physical training instructor's course that I got through the operation, but I hemorrhaged. After the operation, I hemorrhaged, and all I can remember was they were giving me bread to soak up the blood, and it wasn't a very good feeling at all.
It's 1971. You've had the tonsillitis operation. You're hoping to get to Munich, but you haven't had much in the way of training. Then you get appendicitis. Is that right?
So I got out of the army in September, and then I got had an appendectomy, and then when I started training, which is not long after that, I dislocated me right elbow. And so that on top of tonsillitis, appendectomy and a dislocated elbow, we had the trials down in Melbourne in February and I won. And all of this is because of the fitness that I got from the physical training instructor's course.
So even though you didn't pass that physical training instructor's course, it actually gave you a benefit. It made you able to qualify for the Olympics.
Yeah, See, I was one of the fittest people on the course, but it's just that I haven't met skill at 14. You know, you have to know the rules of football, soccer, Aussie rules, and haven't left school at 14. You know, I didn't play rugby league or soccer or anything.
I imagine there was a lot of theory involved in the PT courses.
Yeah, well, there was. And some of the guys that passed, they were school teachers. Some of them were university students. So, yeah. You know, I didn't know the hope in the world. And that I must say that you have disappointments in life, and that was my disappointment. But I made up for it later down the track.
Tell me about the Munich Olympics. You wrestled better in Munich in 1972 than in 1968, but you again faced incredibly tough competition. How close did you come to medalling?
Well, I actually came seventh because I actually had a good draw. I wrestled this South American and I beat him.
There is that wonderful newspaper clipping you sent me, which is, you know, the headline, the front page headline, declaring that you are the only Australian winner on the first day of the 1972 Olympics. Must make you proud looking at that.
It does. And so in round two, I got a bye, which is like winning a competition. And then I got the Italian.
And the Italian only beat you by 2 points, right?
And if I would have beaten the Italian, I might have come third or fourth at the most in the Olympics. And then I got a Romanian who was... The Romanian ended up coming fourth.
You competed in the wrestling events for the first 4 days. The fifth day, you're sitting in the Olympic Village, and then what do you hear?
Oh, bang, bang, bang. And I thought... So I was in Vietnam the year before, so I knew what an AK-47 sounded like. And I thought, oh, not here, because this is the Olympics. And I thought it was probably just firecrackers. And the next day, the manager gets us all together and he says, there's been a hostage situation. And he was actually good friends with the wrestling manager for the Israeli Olympic team. And half the people, it was 11 people killed and half of them were wrestlers.
It must have been devastating for you.
Yeah, it was, and I kind of give up wrestling after the Munich Olympics and then come back out of retirement in 74.
You gave up wrestling because of that massacre?
Up until then, I had a pretty hectic life and I was married and I had a young child. You know, I just had a rest for 2 years and then in 74 I'd come back and I ended up going to Istanbul in 74 for the World Wrestling Championships. I actually got beaten to go to the Commonwealth Games, but I only just started back wrestling and so my fitness wasn't 100%.
I actually
won selection to go to Montreal in 76, but they only sent three wrestlers and they put me as number five.
So in Australia in the 1970s and the 1980s, did you participate in Anzac Day activities?
See, what you've got to remember is when we come back from Vietnam, because of all the publicity on the TV, the media, and then there was the My Lai massacre, and a lot of people put us in the same boat as some of them Americans, you know, that massacred. So I didn't tell anybody that I was a Vietnam veteran. I actually went to an event. I got some free tickets to go to the Bolshoi Ballet, the Russian Bolshoi Ballet. And I actually had my blazer on from the Munich Olympics. And then, you know, I had a lapel and yeah. I had a return serviceman badge there. And at that time, the Russians were in Afghanistan. And you had all these bloody protesters out the front of the movies. And when they saw me return serviceman badge, they were having a go at me for supporting the bloody ballet, going to see them. And they were only performers and, you know, politics. And they didn't see that I was represented Australia as an athlete. They just saw my return serviceman and they they knew that I was a Vietnam veteran, and in Vietnam, I got called up for national service, and it was part of my service to go there. You know, I volunteered, and there's a lot of things that people try to put on to you. But, you know, now I'm very proud of that I went to Vietnam. But back in them days, after Vietnam, you go to the RSLs, and it was like a lot of World War II veterans and Korean veterans, they used to say we weren't actually in a war, if you know what I mean. You know?
Well, that's changed now, thankfully.
Well, it has, and most of the people running the RSLs now are Vietnam veterans, you know.
So you joined the Army Reserve SAS in 1978, and you were in it for 6 years, and you won Commando of the Year in 1981. How proud did that make you?
When I first got called up for national service, I thought, because of my fitness, I wanted to go to SAS, but I thought, you know, they're all hardcore professionals. And leaving school at 14, I was a little bit backward, and I thought I weren't professional enough. So it was just a challenge for me, and the disappointment of not doing the physical training instructor's course, because I'm pretty sure that... the OC of one commando company probably read my records and saw that I dropped out as PDI. But then 3 years later, I became Commando of the Year. And the Commando of the Year was actually voted by the Carter staff, who were the SAS professional staff that trained us, you know. And they're the people who chose who was the best officer and who was the best NCO, and that was the best NCO.
So after retiring from the military, you worked as a driver, and eventually you started to manifest PTSD symptoms. What were they, and how did you cope?
Leading up to 2000, my wife, she got cervical cancer, and in 2001, my mum died, and that kind of... over the years, things were just building up, and did a PTSD, and I ended up in St John of God, and I was out there for 4 weeks, and the first time they put me on an antidepressant was one tablet, and I've come home, and after a week, I couldn't go back to work, and I slept most of the day, and there's no way I could drive.
That can be quite... They can be quite stupefying, can't they?
Yeah. So after a couple of weeks, I rang the psychiatrist, and he said, just take half a tablet. I ended up being on two tablets because I couldn't handle things, and I had to go back to St John of God. So it kind of went downhill.
How long did it take you to recover from your breakdown?
Well, that happened in 2001. Now, in 2003... I used to go to the men's shed out at the Aboriginal Medical Centre at Mount Druitt. And they had a magistrate from the courthouse come to one of our meetings. And they were looking for people. They were going to start this thing called circle sentencing. It was to do with the justice group and the Mount Druitt courthouse. Anyway, I got involved, and then within 12 months, I became secretary of the justice group. And then I've been involved with doing circle sentencing with Mount Druitt and Blacktown courts since 2003 until when I ended up in hospital.
When were you diagnosed with cancer, and what was that fight like?
Well, in October 2018, that's when they discovered that, well, I couldn't breathe properly, so I ended up, I had to have an x-ray, and they said, oh, you've got fluid on the lung. I had to go and get a CAT scan, and they said, oh, you've got a sarcoma in your left lung. And then they said it was... they were going to give me radiation to try and shrink it and then operate. But at Blacktown Hospital, the doctor said he couldn't do it. And they sent me off to palliative support.
Basically, they said, sorry, John, we can't do anything for you. it's terminal. And how did that make you feel? Did that make you want to fight?
Well, it did. You know, I wasn't satisfied with what they, you know. And we actually went to another doctor. He said, because they gave me radiation, he didn't want to operate. But then I found out that he wasn't capable of doing the job. He said, John, go and enjoy life. So me and Yvonne, we booked a trip to Vietnam. And then my good friend, who's a psychiatrist, the doctor, she wasn't happy. And we went to see him on the Tuesday. And on the Wednesday, she rang Chris O'Brien Lifehouse and she got me in there. And she got me a visit on Friday, so I took a little paperwork in there. And then we saw an oncologist there. And then they actually had a big conference. And they put it to all the doctors, can somebody operate on this man? His left lung's got to come out, or the sarcoma's got to come out. Professor Tristan Yan put his hand up, and the rest is all history.
So how big was the sarcoma?
It was 25 centimetres long, and it weighed 4 kilos.
God, so they took out your entire left lung?
Yes.
And have they? How are you now? Are you now cancer-free?
I'm cancer-free.
Congratulations.
I had a scan after, and virtually every 3 months for a couple of months, for a couple of visits I had every 3 months, and then we're down to 6 months, and now it'll be 12 months. So
you see,
all the PET scans are cancer-free.
Good on you, mate. So you're 70 years old now. You've got another 30 or 40 years left in you.
I'm waiting for that letter off the Queen, but I don't think she'd be around.
What's the secret to keeping on fighting? I mean, you've fought your way out of poverty as a kid. You've fought for Australia on the wrestling mat twice at the Olympics. You fought for your country in Vietnam. You fought PTSD and you fought lung cancer. What's the secret to being a fighter like Killer Kinsella?
Well, a lot of people often say it, I'm tough. At that time, when I got diagnosed and then I was told virtually to go and see the palliative support people, if I would have cracked up and started crying, you know, I know even she used to cry when I wasn't around, and I thought if I crack up, everybody's going to think that that's the end of me. But that's what Professor Tristan Yan said. He said, John, he said, you were tough, and that's how you got through the operation. And,
I think you're tough, and that's how you've got through life, but doing it with a laugh. Now, John, what does Anzac Day mean to you?
Well, to me, it's a bit sad, actually, the last 10 years, because I've lost a hell of a lot of mates. They've all died of cancer, and it didn't hit me until I got cancer myself. But let me emphasise that the defoliants they used in Vietnam, the Agent Orange, is definitely what caused the cancer in the Vietnam veterans. And it's not only the Australians, but the Americans. They're all having the same problems. And all the cancers, it's all different. One of my mates, he had a brain tumour, and another one, he had pancreatic cancer, and it just goes on. I had a sarcoma in the left lung, and I actually had a mate come on Anzac Day, and he was standing next to me, and I didn't even recognise him because the amount of weight that he'd lost. And then 2 months after that, he died. And these are the sort of things that hit home. You know, at the time, because you're healthy and you're still alive, I've just had a mate. He's actually got something in his lung now. He's just had his liver operated on, and now he's got something in the lung. And this is all due to the cancers that we got from Vietnam, and not dying of old age, it's cancer-related problems.
So that's the legacy of Vietnam for you.
Yeah, but we're still proud to wear our medals and march on the day. I've actually got the last post, and I'm going to put it on a little recorder, and I'm going to get in the backyard and put my medals on and have my own little parade out the back there. I'll get the daughter to tape it and put it on Facebook.
Good on you, mate. All right, John, yeah. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much, and all the best for Anzac Day and for the next 30, 40, 50 years of your life, mate.
thanks, Michael.
You've been listening to a special bonus episode of Forgotten Australia. The Sydney's Red Year series will conclude after the weekend. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave a rating and review at iTunes because it helps other people find the podcast. Forgotten Australia was written and produced by me in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales on land traditionally owned by the Gundungurra and Darug people. As always, thanks for listening and take care of yourself.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.